Good evening, everyone. Hope all of you are doing great amidst this corona scare that's happening. If there's anything else that you're looking to do apart from reading a book under the self-quarantine, you might as well want to tune into the podcast. I have a very special guest with us today, Spandin Hazarika. He's currently a senior product manager in Verizon Innovation Lab, and he's currently focused on building great customer products on cloud. And he's been in the telecom industry for nearly 15 years and has worked both in the US and in Canada. And he's worked with some great telecom giant companies such as BlackBerry, Roger, Comcast, AT&T. Oh my God, the list is still big. Liberty Global, to name a few. And he has also worked on close to 10 products from the scratch, ideating it to strategizing it, taking it to the market and enabling different launch plans for it. And today at Verizon, he runs a team that's focused on ideation, prototyping, testing, and GTM, which is like go-to-market efforts and initiative. Thank you so much, Spandin, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope I can bring a slightly different perspective. I've listened to most of the podcasts that you've done so far, and it's been an amazing job. So congrats to you guys as well launching this.
Thank you so much, Spandin. So, wow, I really have so many questions to ask you, but let me start off with a very simple one. What or who is an innovation product manager, and how is this different from the normal recognized titles today?
Sure, no, I'm happy to answer that one. So my perspective on this is that it's a little bit different, and this is my personal opinion, right? Is that if you look at how a lot of software product roles specifically are defined, they tend to be focused on things like acquisition, on growth, on search, retention. A lot of it is focused on the optimization of an existing product or model. So within sort of the innovation space, it's a little bit different. And sometimes to explain it best, I try really leaning on the McKinsey Three Horizons model. So the idea there is that you have Horizon 1, a product that you're working on now, and that's what's making you money. Horizon 2 is maybe, you know, you launch it and see the benefit in a few months or years time. And Horizon 3 is something much, much further down the line. It's very transformational. So we tend to focus somewhere between kind of like the edge past Horizon 1, Horizon 2, and a little bit in the Horizon 3. And why that's important is because when we talk about what an innovation product manager is supposed to do there, they play much closer to the role of an entrepreneur inside the company. So like an entrepreneur, basically. So many times the goal is to come with entirely new products and product lines that could be adjacent to the stuff that you're doing right now, or it could be completely new. So it's okay to think of ideas that may be a little bit more risky and stray away from the norm. They just have to be a little bit more forward thinking, right? And we see this in different organizations. The exact role and definition is definitely determined by the organization's mission. Like the best example is probably Alphabet and Project X, where their whole thing is moonshots, really, really revolutionary stuff really far out, right? So we're probably not at that Horizon 3 stuff. We're a little more in the Horizon 2 side of things. So we tend to ideate a lot. We prototype, we test it, we sell the idea and the vision, and then we go build it if people like it, right? And the big thing here is that there's a strong possibility that you're going to fail a lot. So it's similar to being an entrepreneur and doing a startup in the sense that there's a lot of things you're going to try and a lot of things you're going to be wrong about, a lot of things that you're going to fail at. For a typical, you know, product management role, that may be encouraged in some organizations, maybe not. You know, it's not always kind of the norm. So it's okay to have that expectation. So for us now, our new purpose that we kind of relaunched with is our purpose statement is we create the networks that move the world forward. So it's important that when we talk about networks, we're not talking about just as a telecom network, but also networks with people and social aspects. So what are we doing for society as well? So we tend to be able to look at a lot of different verticals and spaces and say, what can we do here? So within the building, we have teams that are focused on, you know, smart cities, security of the future, digital identity, IoT, AR, VR, 5G is the biggest hot topic at this point, and the next generation of cloud computing. So, you know, from our perspective, we tend to focus on the kind of these different verticals of what can we do here to really give value to our customers. That would be a whole new product line or area of the business that, you know, if everything fell apart, what could we evolve into? Basically, as become a technology company, not just a telecom company.
Wow, that's great. So innovation always kind of scares me because you know, there's no limit to thoughts and no limits to bring your vision, your idea into, you know, that's just pen and paper to an actual product. So how did you end up in this role? I'm very inquisitive to know more about it.
Yeah, and I definitely love that question, because listening to a lot of your guests, they have some really interesting journeys that they got there. The one sort of consistent thing is no one sort of planned to be in product management. So,
right,
there's so many paths to get into this. So, you know, my specific journey is that I was trained as an electrical engineer in college, and I focused on wireless communication systems. But on the side, maybe I just have ADD or something, I'm not sure, I decided I want to do something different too. So I actually worked on a side project with a team where we actually built a solar car. When I say a car, it's a car that you could get into as a driver, put onto a highway and go 120 kilometers an hour.
Wow.
And the goal there was to take that car to Australia and race it against a bunch of other crazy university kids that were doing things. So I bring this up because that's probably, I didn't realize at the time, my first foray into product management. Because my role there was to create the array that took the sunlight and turned that into electricity. That was my specific role. So it was a lot of the same aspects. When I look back at it now, having been in product management for a little while, I was like, oh, wow, I was actually doing that stuff, but didn't really realize. And there's a lot of transferable skills, right? So as I kind of went through that journey, I also was like, okay, well, I'm studying wireless systems, so I should do something in that space and telecom. I ended up working at RIM and BlackBerry, and I was working in QA and certification. So basically, before a device hits the market, you have to make sure that it plays nicely. It's following certain protocol, that it's not, you know, talking at the wrong time. So we did a lot of testing and certification to make sure devices were adhering to protocols before they hit the market. And I was on the team that helped launch the BlackBerry Pearl, which I don't know if you remember way back in the day, right? Was like the move from the BlackBerry with the side scrolling to that smaller consumer product with like a little trackball in the middle. So it's really interesting times to kind of watch how products and like really great products are made. Because right around the time that launched, BlackBerry was doing amazing, great stock prices. About a year later, Apple came up with the iPhone, and the whole industry got turned upside down. So just super fun kind of watching that. So I realized that despite like knowing how all the stuff worked technically, I didn't have a good handle on how business and strategy worked. So after I graduated, I actually elected to take a role in the consulting world. And I joined basically a few different consulting firms to get a better understanding of how technology and strategy and business work together. So as part of that, I learned how commercial software works and how technical architectures work and how they support the business objectives. And through kind of roles there, so I ended up doing two different product management roles for clients. And I realized that that's effectively where my passions were. It was that perfect blend of technology mixing with strategy and business. And I realized product management was going to be the thing for me. And that's when I decided, hey, Verizon was a great opportunity based on my experience with telecom. And something opened up that was very close to home. I applied and, you know, I interviewed with the team. We went through a lot of different processes and talked about products. And, you know, it worked out well. And that was 4 years ago, and I've been enjoying the experience since.
Wow, that is so great. Like, you have literally done everything, a hardware product to a software product to everything in the market. So that brings me to the next question, since it's a very broad spectrum. You've also told me in our previous interactions that you were, you know, heading 10 different products in a very short span of 4 years. Like, for so many, this 4 years, they would have done like maximum of 2 to 3 products, but 10 is a very huge number. I cannot even think all the innovations and all the strategy that would have, you know, that would have been required for all these 10 different products. So how's your journey there? And that, could you just tell me more about it? Because 10 different is just like too much for anybody to do it in a very short span of 4 years.
Yeah, it's really important to highlight that a big aspect of that number is that word I said before, which is failure. So I'm not going to say that every single one of those products is a super successful one, but we got to work on 10 different ideas and products and took it to a good spot before kind of like, maybe this doesn't make sense or sunset, right? So the journey there was basically when I initially got hired, I was brought in to work on a single product, you know, 4 years ago. So this is the idea of using data as a currency. So back when we used to sell like phone plans as 2 gigabytes, 4 gigabytes, 8 gigabytes, whatever it might be, right? So we were exploring this concept of like, hey, could you basically incentivize people by saying, hey, if you do this action, you can earn 5 gigabytes or data or something like that, using data as a currency. Now I worked on that product for a few months, and then very shortly after, with like realignment and stuff like that, the entire industry moved towards unlimited plans in the US. So effectively, that whole concept of using it as a currency died, right? Like it just wasn't,
right.
It didn't make sense to continue that product. So luckily, you know, luckily or unluckily, I guess, you are always constrained in the resource world for a product. You always need more resources, and there were resource gaps for other initiatives that were taking off. So at the time, there was an opportunity where basically we were taking some internal technology team had worked on and said, hey, what if we were to productize these and take them and sell them to other partners, basically. So there was a gap there. And my manager basically said, hey, take this role over here for right now and move into it. And then from there, basically, one thing led to another. And I got a chance to work with, you know, some pretty interesting people from architects who wrote papers on how to make the internet go faster and filed patents. And then having to work with sales and enterprise sales teams and business development teams, because taking what the architects did and what the engineers did in developing these platforms, they have to now present them to C-suite executives from global telecoms and be like, hey, you guys really need this because we used it. It was like super successful. So, you know, from there, another opportunity opened up where it said, okay, as part of selling one of these products, we need to come up with a better business case. You know, should we be doing this product on hardware internally in our data centers, or do we move to a cloud solution like AWS and GCP? So I moved off of that project.
Right.
I wanted to do a business case to make the justification for spending millions of dollars in OPEX versus CAPEX. So a lot of time spent on that one. And finally, when that project was over, we made a decision to say, hey, we're going to stay on this hardware over here. But now we actually have some problems in these products over here, and we have to provide some strategy and innovation for these consumer products. So an opportunity opened up where we decided, hey, fintech is going to be an interesting space to take a look at. And Verizon just announced that we're going to be going into, our first attempt at going to that space there. So we received approval to launch a trial. So I basically kind of worked with the team to pull together trials to say, like, here's a fintech product that we have. What do people think about it? What does that feedback look like? And once that concluded and we got the approval to say, let's go ahead and launch this, another opportunity opened up, basically, because, again, coming from the consulting world, my profile fit very well with that concept of like airdrop into a new project, you know, go into the school and figure it out. So I got invited to join a team that was focused on, you know, personal cloud, backup and storage for our customers. So they said, what can we do here to make this an interesting thing? Because those kind of products typically tend to be utilities. You know, you set and you forget it, you don't really go back to it. So what can we do to add more value, differentiate the marketplace? So, you know, one of the things we did recently is we launched a beta lab where we were able to basically launch features and get a sense of like, hey, is this going to be something that customers are going to like? And, you know, when we launched in a few weeks, and within a few weeks, we had a few thousand users giving us feedback and stuff like that. So it's been super helpful in streamlining our process of innovation to say, here's this big backlog of ideas that we're trying to take a look at. So what of these are customers actually asking for? Or what are we missing that customer asking for that we should start prioritizing? So that's sort of been the journey. Every single time an opportunity opened up, there's a sort of a skill gap. Just kind of like, hey, you know, maybe you can get you off this project onto this one over here and help the team move forward on this one over here, basically. So that's effectively how it worked because, again, but my background happened to fit that role perfectly.
Right. Looks like every place that you jumped off was just like the perfect landing ground that you created for yourself. Very great story there.
I couldn't have asked for it any better.
Right. So I just want to focus more on the very fundamentals, right? Since you gave life to all of these 10 different products in some aspect of the other, how do someone focus more on ideation versus launch versus incremental updates to, you know, make the product more market reach? Could you talk on different stages, on some key takeaways in different stages?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a great bucketing of the question, right? So let me start with kind of ideation, right? So the first key takeaway is that ideation is hard. Or let me say that differently.
Really? Yes.
You can come up with a lot of ideas. Ideas are easy. Execution and value proposition, they're really hard, right?
Right.
So, and even kind of bringing a team together to work on this, I'm not saying that we've perfected this at all. You know, we're probably in our third iteration of how we kind of bring ideas to the table and kind of bring them to life. But it's very hard, and there aren't very many silver bullets. You have to kind of know the skill set of the team and the interests of the team and make sure those are aligned as well. So the very first takeaway is that, you know, if you're finding it hard, it's because it is hard. There's no silver bullet there, aside from, you know, working with the team to figure out how people work best, right? The second key takeaway is that you're going to have a lot of ideas. Most of them will be bad.
Right.
There's nothing wrong in admitting that, right? It's okay to put them down for the sake of, you know, going through design thinking different approaches, like just throw as many ideas on the table, because sometimes one idea might spur somebody else to be like, oh, what if we tweaked it in this way over here? Would this be a different way of solving the custom problem that we're going after, right? So it's okay to throw a lot of ideas onto the table, just knowing and not taking personal offense that a lot of them will be bad and they may not necessarily fly. Because in the ideation phase, you may not have a lot of data initially. You're going to it very, very raw. And sometimes one of the ways that helps out is that if you say, okay, guys, instead of just ideating blindly, let's pick a specific area that we can focus on. So this is one of the approaches we're trying right now. Is we have the specific area that we think is going to be very valuable to our customers based on feedback. What within this domain should we be focused on within, you know, let's say, this is not the exact example, but like the education or something like that, right? What could we be doing in this space, basically? So then it helps kind of create a little bit of some constraints. And sometimes it's good to ideate within constraints, and sometimes it's good to kind of open up a little more green field. So it really depends on sort of the business objectives. So a lot of it is to go back and say, okay, make sure that whatever we're doing is actually strategically useful to the company's purpose and mission, right? That second idea is, again, so most of the ideas you're going to have will be bad. The third sort of takeaway with ideation I found is that it's really important to get to validation quickly, because a lot of times when people come up with ideas, people get very married to the idea. And I've been guilty of this myself for sure. Right? You have an idea like, oh, that's such a great idea. I would totally use that. But oftentimes with the phrase is like, well, you're a hammer looking for a nail, right? You have this idea for a product. You're like, oh, we can solve this problem and this problem and this problem. But have you even validated if this is even a problem or not? Have you done that customer empathy, which I think a lot of your previous guests have talked about as well, right? So it's really important that once you kind of get those ideas, to get to validation quickly to say, is this even a problem? Am I even addressing a problem statement that is actually valid or a pain point? Because that's one of the biggest things that we tend to have discussions on internally when we present visions and ideas, is this really a problem? Where's the evidence? So you have to get that evidence quickly. And, you know, we've used combinations of user testing. We've reached out to customers that have given us consent to talk to them. I've gone so far as to go into a store and stand there and ask customers questions to be like, hey, is this a problem or not, right? So you have to be very resourceful in that space, right? So that's where Lisa can like to wrap it all up in the ideation space. My fourth kind of key takeaway is that it really works most effectively when you start with a problem area or kind of like a vertical to kind of focus on. Otherwise, it's very easy to just kind of throw stuff against a wall and see what happens. And we've seen that happen in two different iterations of our process, and it ends up being very ineffective. So it's good to kind of, you know, see if that works with the team. If it doesn't, very quickly probably pivot to, okay, let's ideate in this specific place and make sure we start with problem statements and validation. So those are probably my key takeaways in the ideation phase at the very least. So the idea is, once you've got the idea, is that you've got validation that this is a problem. Now you have an idea for a product and how you're going to solve for that problem. So you can start making those prototypes. And the most important thing here is test. That's the first in kind of the launch process is test and get validation. Make prototypes, use Envision, use prototyping tools, wireframes. I'm actually not that fancy. I tend to actually just go to Google Slides or PowerPoint and paste a bunch of like images that I find on Google and put together a fake prototype and make it almost clickable. You know, that's because I didn't have access to a designer at the time. I just did that. So if you have access to a designer, definitely, you know, work with them collaboratively to come up with that prototype and show it to people. Because when we did this for one of our apps, we learned very quickly that, hey, our initial version of this is that this feels kind of weird. It's not really identifying with that customer. We're missing the age group that we're trying to talk to. So like make it feel a little bit different. So we got feedback, we changed the entire look and feel. And the second time around, it made a lot more sense when we took it to like some early validation. So, you know, that was kind of the first key takeaway is that iterate and test, iterate, test, iterate, test, right? The second thing is that along the way, you're going to have a lot of doubters and a lot of people that are going to have a lot of opinions about if this is right or wrong. The best advice I can give here is that don't fight. Don't fight. Don't fight and just kind of spout opinion. Make friends by using data, right? Where possible, get data to back up your evidence. And that's always going to be the thing that helps you get the most traction. But it's not worth having a fight about these kind of things. It's better to try to convince and say, here's the data, you know, let's discuss it from a database approach, right?
Right.
Thirdly is, as you test, once you kind of feel like you're at a good point, it's good to actually start making that prototype, which may not be working necessarily, and create almost like an MVP, not even a commercial MVP, something that's close enough that gets the idea across. Start with your objective. And then launch a trial if you have that capability. Go recruit a few people to use it for a little while. It may not have to be launched. There are ways to do this, and where, especially with software, you could do early versions of it that aren't public just yet, right? So that's why a lot of companies and organizations tend to do more of like a beta approach to or alpha approach to kind of product launches, right? So number three, launch a trial for sure. Number four, whatever plan you come up with, it's always going to take longer to develop than you think. Where possible, build in as much time as you can for some sort of slippage, knowing that there are going to be some things to unaccount for, because you will always get feedback from your more senior stakeholders saying that you got to pull that timeline in. So definitely build in some flexibility for the ability to pivot, because we learned something new and maybe it makes sense to change the roadmap a little bit, right? And finally, as you kind of get into the development process, it's really important that you start testing very, very early. And start with a good test plan, right? So in the very early stages of our trials, I actually helped write the test plans because our QA team wasn't quite ready yet. And that's because I started off my career in the QA and testing world. So it made it a lot easier to say, okay, here's kind of like a basic test plan. Let's now collaborate and build this out a little bit more. And it's important that you establish a good relationship with them, because at the end of the day, when development is inevitably going to get crunched, it's the QA team that's going to get the most pressure to okay it and try to get it out the door, unfortunately, right? So, you know, the fifth takeaway in the launch step is, you know, start testing early, early, early.
Right.
So, you know, that's kind of like, I think my biggest takeaways in the ideation and kind of launch space. Within the post-launch and sort of incremental updates, it's a little bit different, because now you're out in market and now you have an entire backlog of things you decided not to do. And you're back to sort of this prioritization thing. You kick the can down the road. So a really important thing at this point is to establish prioritization criteria to figure out what's important and what features are going to win early. And hand in hand with that, once you establish prioritization criteria, is it revenue you're chasing? Is it engagement? Is it acquisition? Kind of choose from, like, you know, your main objective you're trying to hit. Make sure you identify who the key stakeholders are in making those decisions. And make sure they're informed of why the roadmap is changing as necessary, right? And again, I'll go back to customer feedback. So once you actually have the product out in market, you may have like 10 customers, go talk to all 10 customers. You may have 1,000 customers, go talk to some of those customers. So find a way to get customer feedback any way that you can, because that pretty much is going to trump anything else that people will be able to say. So you really need those customers to be the first one to say, hey, this is great. I'm going to tell other people about it to kind of help the growth of your product.
Right. Great. So just out of curiosity, you know, once you launch the product, you might have another set of features that you'd always want to incorporate in it. Has it ever matched with what your customers wanted? Or, you know, would customers always bring in an element of surprise when you go and talk to them about it?
Oh, there's always an element of surprise, right? So there are some things that if you kind of take a look at it, that's the beautiful part about the product management world, in my opinion. What I love about it is that no 2 days are the same, right? Because on one day I have, you know, these 30 customers that are like, hey, I really want this feature over here. And then, you know, 10 days later, I look at that backlog because of the feedback and suddenly I should be customers with a thing over here kind of thing, right? So we get daily emails from our app store ratings that say like, hey, this is what customers complained about. And we take that very seriously, where we actually have a team that's focused on reviewing those and reaching out to customers preemptively, saying like, hey, we're sorry about this experience. What can we do to fix it? And then passing the feedback back to the product team as well to make sure that we have that feedback like, hey, people are really needing this gap over here. There's an error that we're not seeing in our logs and so on and so forth. So yeah, definitely it never really goes as planned. So it's really good to have the right relationships and figure out who hands off where.
Right. Right. That's something I think I guessed it right there, but then I just want to ask from you. Right. So the next question is telecom product management. You've been working with some of the tech giants, and you've always been, at the exact point where the technology always was disruptive, especially when it comes to the telecom industry, given that you've also worked with both hardware and software. So how is telecom PM different from other typical PMs that we have today?
Yeah, so a lot of things to consider there, right? So probably the number one thing to keep in mind is a telecom network especially has to offer incredibly high reliability. The network has to always be on. So anything that you're doing that could result in a disruption is going to be met with a lot of sensitivity and scrutiny. So the number one thing is, if you're launching something, if it's going to touch any network component, it's going to involve, buy-in from a lot of folks and a lot of testing. So you just have to make sure that you're not compromising the reliability of the network, especially in times like these. People really rely on the ability to connect. So it's really important that you take that aspect seriously. So the incredibly high reliability is probably one of the top criteria that may even trump something like revenue sometimes, right? Let's make sure we're not going to go after revenue if it means that we're going to potentially sacrifice the reliability for our customers, right? That's one. The second is that, because working at a telecom company or, just an internet provider as well, whether it's like a Comcast or Charter type client, there's a big target on your back. So there's a very big aspect of security. So we work with a dedicated security team to, as we make sure that we're putting out product, there's a review from the security team to make sure we're not compromising anything and we're doing things that are in line with leading practices in the industry. So right. Because we have so much information, we have a responsibility to keep that stuff safe. So we have to take the reliability and security aspect of it very, very seriously, right? Thirdly, there aren't very many telecom companies or hardware companies that aren't really public. So, it's very high visibility. If you do something, if it goes badly, it could end up on the news, and that could undermine things, how stockholders feel about the company and the stock price shareholder faith, basically. So there's a lot of visibility. So the security aspect of it, and also making sure that you have uptime, results in direct impact to the company. So even if you're working on a smaller product, headlines can sometimes be a bad thing. Sometimes it can be a good thing. So it's really important to make sure that as you're doing things, that you're kind of following the right go-to-market processes and channels to make sure that you're not compromising it. And that's different than a lot of startups that may not have that kind of public scrutiny just yet, because they're just getting going. So they have a little more flexibility in making mistakes sometimes and learning from them. We don't always have that luxury. So we have to be much more careful before launch.
Right.
And another aspect also is that we tend to work a lot within the industry in a very collaborative manner. So when we look at products, one of the biggest questions we have to decide on is this something that we go and build in house? Are we the right people to go hire people and go make it? Do we buy it off the shelf? Is that going to help us in terms of time to market? Or do we go and partner with somebody and co-develop it as well? And probably every single product I've worked on so far here, we've had to answer that question. It's like, why would it make sense to go build it versus going partnering and buying it to market quickly? And that tends to be a little bit different, because in a lot of kind of pure software plays, you're making the software. So there's a really different approach of working with partners, vendors, and so on and so forth. And oftentimes it could be multiple parties trying to get one product out the door, right? Yeah, and I just have kind of one final thought on the telecom PM difference is a lot of times, because it didn't historically start as a software development shop, it's agile development is a growing competency. It's not core necessarily. There are some groups that do it amazingly and some groups that are just getting going on it right now. And, you could have IT teams that are working on one schedule versus your product team that are working on a different schedule, and your sprints may not match. So there's a lot of handoffs to figure out there. So definitely one thing that's a little bit different versus pure software is that whole aspect of scale agile is still kind of happening in a lot of places. And I'm talking about this, where I'm right now, it's going to happen time and time again in different places. So a little bit different than how kind of small startups tend to work and develop software and get out the door, because there's aspects of software, hardware, and network components to figure out, and different teams doing it, right?
Right. Awesome. I think whenever it comes to large enterprise companies, there's always a build versus buy, you know, internal biases that you have. So that brings me to the next question. What are some of the misconception about product management in large enterprise companies? Could you give me like something that I always think is that, you know, companies like PayPal or anything that I personally know, there's always an internal bias where they'd be like, hey, I'm not sure if I have to build versus buy, because like you said, you always have an opportunity to collaborate with people in the market. So what are some of the misconceptions about PM or product management in a large enterprise companies?
Oh man, so many.
Right. You're like, where do I begin? Right.
Yeah, where do I start? Right. So let me go with three of them here. Right. So I think the first probably biggest misconception is that, like, if you're a startup and you're kind of looking at like a very large company, like, oh man, those guys have unlimited resources. That's really not true. I mean, there's a lot of resources, but there's a lot of people that need those resources as well. And you don't always have first access to say, I need a designer right now. I need a QA team right now, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. You have to plan for those things. And if you can't get them, you still are on the hook to deliver product. So you still have to be resourceful, right? So like I said, like if we didn't have access to a research team, I've literally just called up a store manager and said, hey, can I stand in your store and talk to customers while you're serving? Because I need validation for my features. I have no other way of validating what I need to go do here right now. So, one biggest misconception is that, like, I don't have access to unlimited resources. But there are times when, you know, when we have them, it's great. When we don't, you have to be resourceful, right? So that's one.
Right.
The second, I think, misconception is that people are like, well, you have all this data. You have so much data. That's true. But again, going back to what I'm kind of saying about the difference is that, like, because of being a large company, you can be a target in the marketplace from, you know, hackers, cyber criminals, and so on and so forth. So we have to be very careful about who has access to, especially customer data, and what we use that for.
Exactly.
Between kind of protecting the data and making sure we're complying with consent and, you know, all of the great stuff that's happening in the market, we don't always have access to that data, and we have to be careful how we have the data, how we store it. So we have a lot of kind of trainings on like how we go and do that stuff. So yes, there's a ton of data, but not everyone has access to all of it, and that's really by design.
Right.
And the third concept is probably the misconception is that, hey, you know, if you are a big company, you have this brand, you launch something, it's going to be successful. Your brand is enough. And that really isn't true. Branding is like...
Okay, that's a myth burst for me, but yeah, I think, yeah.
No, it's a very deliberate process. You have to work very closely with the marketing team to say, hey, as product, when we came up with this, here's the value proposition of who the customer is. Here's your evidence of why we think we can succeed. And these are some of the ways that we think we can talk to customers and who the customers are. And, you know, we have to hand it off and work with them collaboratively to make sure that conversation is happening in the right way. But knowing that they're the experts in that space and saying, okay, I'm going to take a backseat to help you out, be a resource to you. But let's make sure that this gets out the door. Because if you, that old phrase, like build it and they will come, like not true at all, right? Like if you're not solving a pain point and delighting a customer better than the competitors, even all the competitors, you're just not going to win. So you can't take any product, throw your big company brand on it and think that you're going to succeed. You may have some moderate success, but it's not going to be a runaway success just because you have a brand. Brand equity is something that is earned every single day. So we always have to keep that in mind. So probably one of the biggest misconceptions.
Great point there. Really great point. Yes. Wow. That's like so much of information in our conversation there, Spondon. Very last question. I think we are almost towards the end of the session. I'm an aspiring product manager, and all of our listeners, at least close to 50% of them, are someone who's just trying to get into product management space. So what would be two quick advices that you'd like to give to an aspiring product manager, and why?
So the first one I'd probably say is you just have to be very naturally curious. So whenever you're kind of playing a role that has any kind of product impact, or even if you're not in that right now, let's say you're in a QA role or something like that, which I fully recommend people do, take on roll up your sleeve kind of role, be curious, ask a lot of questions, and always seek to understand what it is that you're trying to deliver and solve for, and you can deliver a lot more value. So if you see numbers and projections, do some mental math and validate that those things make sense. Not to question like, hey, did you do this correctly? But if you had to re-explain to somebody else, can you justify why you're doing it, right? So always be curious for any presentation that you see. Ask questions and learn about why. Ask a lot of why questions, right? That's one. There's tons of others to choose from, but I guess a lot of people have already talked about these ones. So maybe the next one I could talk about is actually, I don't think I've heard anyone say this, is practice storytelling.
So much of
what you have to do is to get stakeholders on board. You have to sell visions, you have to present. So it's important that you get comfortable with the ability to tell a story in sort of a fluid manner. And that doesn't always come naturally for everybody. It didn't for me initially, so it took a while. You know, one tip that you could try probably, if you have access to it, is take an acting class. Very simple fix there, but you can learn the very basics of how to have sort of presence and kind of learn about how to communicate and look for cues when communicating with people. That's always a good place to start as well. So if you can learn how to tell a good story, that's honestly probably half the battle, because you have to repeat the story over and over and over, change it over time, and sell something. So those are probably my top two I'd probably tell people.
Wow, that's a great point. I've never really heard someone say that, you know, practice storytelling, but I have definitely heard feedbacks about how people say, you know what, you could definitely work more on the articulation bit of it. I can definitely, you know, it rings a bell for me right now. All right, Spawn. So that was one great episode. And thank you so much for your time on the call. I have personally learned so much, and I am hoping, and I definitely know that our audience would also learn so much about more on telecom PMs and how to launch versus ideate versus have a good go-to-market strategy. Thank you so much for your time, Spawn. And do take care of yourself and the family during this corona time.
You too. Thanks so much. I love having being on this episode. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.